Good evening and welcome to the study of March 13th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1848 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green with you again today, and we have our study today from paragraph 7 of chapter 8 of the Crucible article, Crucible of Credible Creed, C3, chapter 8, paragraph 7. The Fayum region had two lakes added with the completion in 1973 CE of the Wadi El Rayyan irrigation project. These new lakes being then created, the result of diverting some of the Fayum's drainage water here, away from Lake Karun. It is true that Lake Karun is today tiny compared with its former freshwater glory, its evaporating water having left it with a concentration of minerals like that of seawater. Before 1973, the water of the Fayum had drained completely into the same Lake Karun to the north, causing it to rise, destroying farmland because of the saltiness of the water. So there had been enough minerals that had built up over some time that even when water was added to the lake and it overflowed, it was still too salty. Locals to the Fayum say that the great lake and swamps in the area were quote-unquote drained by the biblical patriarch, Joseph. That is the most remarkable thing that we are interested in, because this chapter is about Joseph. In the days of Pharaoh Moiris, however, the one whom we have argued is one of the sons of Joseph, actually the son that was called by the Hebrew name Manasseh. However, the lake was above sea level in the days of Moiris by 18 meters. So he didn't just drain the Great Lake, he also filled the area of Lake Karun and that Fayum region with water during the reign of Moiris, because we know Joseph was working for the Pharaoh Moiris, according to the Arab history of their tradition, the Arabian traditional history. Now, over the course of millennia, Lake Karun has fallen to the present 45 meters below sea level. That's a 63-meter drop from 18 meters above sea level. And how was it maintained above sea level? That would be rather difficult. There would be apparently a lot of... Well, how would you maintain it above sea level if the Nile is flowing? Well, because the Nile is flowing downhill, that's why, toward the sea, so the Nile is above sea level at the Fayum region. But when the Nile doesn't drain into Lake Karun, the level of the lake can fall for various reasons, depending on how much water is available and so on. To these faithful ones who believe, this is an important point, to these faithful ones who believe, Joseph's high position in the Egyptian government of ancient times is not hidden. Egypt's most important canal, Bar Yosef, is named after the patriarch Joseph, who worked on canals as Senusret II. Yeah, apparently he was the same person as Senusret II, or he would have had to have been working for him if he wasn't the same person, evidently, because Joseph himself was living at that time. Because it was Senusret II who built Joseph's canal. So he was either the same person as Joseph, which is the most likely thing. It seems incredible to say that, but that's the most likely scenario. Or he was working for Senusret II, but if he was working for Senusret II, the canal would not be named after Joseph. It would be named after Senusret. unless Joseph was Senyasret. So it makes only sense. It only makes sense. And that's the only way it can make sense at all, is if Joseph is Senyasret II. It's very clear. Whether he served as Pharaoh earlier in his career, although this astounding truth has so been hidden by anti-Semitism, but whether Joseph served as the Pharaoh earlier in his career and later assisted Pharaoh Moiris, identified by us as the son of Joseph Manasseh, and also called Proteus, the old man of the sea, that is Moiris, whether Joseph served as Pharaoh and later assisted Moiris as the son of Joseph, that we see that there's evidence Moiris was the son of Joseph. Everything ties in with this. It all fits together perfectly. It's not any stretch to say this. The only thing that we're lacking is explicit documentary evidence, right, in the Bible or wherever. We have all the circumstantial evidence that shows that this is really the case. But it's not, you know, whether Joseph was the Pharaoh earlier in his career and later assisted Moiris is a point of relatively less significance than the clear truth that Israel had lived in Egypt and that Joseph had ruled, which is what the Bible says. That's all that the Bible says. It doesn't say that Joseph was the Pharaoh, and it doesn't have to. The Bible never is trying to brag about things. So maybe it's just modesty or whatever. It's not trying to declare great, great worldly fame, which would be unimportant to Jehovah. Anyway, Jehovah wouldn't care about that. Jehovah cares about the truth, and he cares about his own purpose, not about the world. But the Greek god Poseidon, the incredible thing here, the Greek god Poseidon appears and styled after Joseph as the ruler of the sea. And what does Poseidon mean? It means lord of On, the city On, Poseidon, lord of On. Joseph was the high priest he married the daughter of the priest of On. He became the lord of On, but he was the ruler of the sea because he was the one who built this incredible canal. That's why he's called Poseidon. Riding in a chariot, Poseidon does, just like Joseph did. He rode in a chariot that was the Pharaoh's chariot. The chariot is said to have been brought into Egypt by the Hyksos. That means not that particular chariot, but the idea of chariots was brought by the Hyksos, the people later identified by Josephus as Israel. See, Josephus wrongly identified the Hyksos as Israel. They weren't the Hyksos. But it's clear that the chariot can be connected to the Israelites because it's connected to Semites, who were the Hyksos. Poseidon had a son. Also, Poseidon had a son, Proteus, who was called the Old Man of the Sea, who is like one Herodotus called Moiris. Poseidon's son, Proteus, fits the Old Man of the Sea. As for the other kings, Herodotus writes, they could tell me of no great works which had been produced by them. And they said that they had no renown except only the last of them, Moiris. He, they said, produced as a memorial of himself the gateway of the temple of Hephaestus, which is turned toward the north wind, and dug a lake, about which I shall set forth afterwards. He dug a lake, obviously that's Lake Moiris, about which I shall set forth afterward how many furlongs of circuit it has, and in it built pyramids of the size which I shall mention at the same time when I speak of the lake itself. He, they said, Herodotus writes, produced these works, but of the rest none produced any. That's all for our study for today. Little children, we're going to read 2 Chronicles chapter 3. And it's short today. We have both our readings are short. Finally, Solomon started to build the house of Jehovah in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where Jehovah had appeared to David his father in the place that David had prepared on the thrashing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Accordingly, he started to build in the second month, on the second day, in the fourth year of his reign. A statement from verse 2 that agrees with 1 Kings 6 and 1, where it said, in the 480th year, after the sons of Israel came out from the land of Egypt, and then it says, in the fourth year, in the month of Ziv, that is, the second month after Solomon became king over Israel, that he proceeded to build the house to Jehovah, completely in agreement with the additional fact of the 480th year after leaving Egypt, which we've used in the chronology also. So 1014 would be year 4 if Solomon's year 1 is 1017, as long as we've interpreted what the word fourth means correctly, which is hard to say. Sometimes it means fourth and sometimes it means fifth, as we've seen, but it's possible that we can also take Solomon as beginning to rule prior to 1017. It's just that David was not dying until after Solomon became king. So it's 1014 is the year we have for the fourth year of Solomon's reign. And that's when he began the foundation of the temple. That's important because that year is... it's not so critical, maybe. It's well established. It's a pivotal. It's a milestone year in the chronology that is the basis for the other dates when we add and subtract the number of 2,268 years to it and from it. And these things Solomon laid as a foundation for building the house of the true God, the length in cubits by the former measurement being 60 cubits, and the width 20 cubits. The former measurement could be a cubit by the former measurement. Sounds like the long cubit that was like the Egyptian cubit. I forget what we said it was in the Ark of Urartu. I forgot. I was going to look that up. I forgot to look it up. What did the Ark of Urartu say about the long cubit? It's in the Ark of Urartu. It's the only place we have it that I can think of. Let's see, what's this? It's over here somewhere, I think. There it is. Yeah, it's in Ark of Urartu, part 1. Right here. So, here it is. Cubit of... The Great Babylonian cubit was 21 inches. Um, 20.6 is the number we used for the Egyptian cubit. There it is, 20.6 right here. Egyptian cubit, 20.6 inches. Okay. That was good to find that out. And, sorry, we're not in the article anymore. We're in this chapter 3 of 2 Chronicles. And the porch that was in front of the length of the temple was 20 cubits in front of the width of the house. So it was 20 by 20, in other words, and its height was 20 cubits, if you look at the Septuagint version. The Masoretic text, if you look at one version of the Septuagint, it's 20 cubits. And if you look at the Masoretic texts and the other version of the Septuagint, it's 120, it says, which is, it doesn't mention the word cubits. But it looks like a transcriber or copyist error. And he proceeded to overlay it, so it should say 20. We know the height was not going to be 120. If it was 20 cubits wide, it wouldn't be 120 high. That's just unreasonable. And he proceeded to overlay it inside with pure gold, and the great house he covered with juniper wood, after which he covered it with good gold. And then he brought up upon it palm tree figures and chains. Further, he overlaid the house with precious stone for beauty, and the gold was gold from the gold country. And he went on to cover the house, the rafters, the thresholds, and its walls, and its doors with gold, and he engraved cherubs upon the walls. And he proceeded to make the house of the Most Holy, its length in relation to the width of the house being 20 cubits, and its own width being 20 cubits. And then he covered it with good gold to the amount of 600 talents, and the weight for the nails was 50 gold shekels. And the roof chambers he covered with gold. Then he made in the house of the Most Holy two cherubs in the workmanship of images, and overlaid them with gold. As for the wings of the cherubs, their length was 20 cubits, the one wing of 5 cubits reaching to the wall of the house, and the other wing of 5 cubits reaching to the wing of the other cherub. And the wing of the one cherub of 5 cubits was reaching to the wall of the house, and the other wing of 5 cubits was in contact with the wing of the other cherub. The wings of these cherubs were spread out 20 cubits, and they were standing upon their feet with their faces inward. Further, he made the curtain of blue thread and wool dyed reddish, purple, and crimson, and fine fabric, and worked in cherubs upon it. Then he made before the house two pillars, 35 cubits in length, and the capital that was upon the top of each one was 5 cubits. Further, he made chains in necklace style and put them upon the tops of the pillars, and made 100 pomegranates and put them on the chains. And he proceeded to set up the pillars in front of the temple, one to the right and one to the left, after which he called the name of the right-hand one Jachin, and the name of the left-hand one Boaz. That's the end of 2 Chronicles chapter 3. Little children, wasn't that a very interesting chapter about the construction of God's temple? Amos chapter 4. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan. Now, Bashan is north of the land of Gilead, on the east side of the Jordan, who are on the mountain of Samaria, who are defrauding the lowly ones, who are crushing the poor ones, who are saying to their masters, "Do bring and let us drink." The sovereign Lord Jehovah has sworn by his holiness, "Look, there are days coming upon you, and he will certainly lift you up with butcher hooks, and the last part of you with fish hooks, and by breaches you will go forth, each one straight ahead, and you will certainly be thrown out to Harmon," is the utterance of Jehovah. "Come, you people, to Bethel, and commit transgression. At Gilgal, be frequent in committing transgression, and bring your sacrifices in the morning, on the third day your tenth parts. And from what is leavened, make a thanksgiving sacrifice to smoke, and proclaim voluntary offerings, publish it, for that is the way you have loved. O sons of Israel," is the utterance of the sovereign Lord Jehovah. Jehovah's being very, what's the word? We'll think about it. "And I also, for my part, gave you people cleanness of teeth in all your cities, and want of bread in all your places, but you did not come back to me," is the utterance of Jehovah. "And as for me, I also withheld from you people the downpour when there were yet 3 months to the harvest. And I made it rain on one city, but on another city I would not make it rain. There was one tract of land that would be rained on, but a tract of land on which I would not make it rain would be dried up. And two or three cities staggered to one city, in order to drink water, and they would not get satisfied. But you did not come back to me, is the utterance of Jehovah. I struck you people with scorching and mildew. There was a multiplying of your gardens and of your vineyards. But your fig trees and your olive trees the caterpillar would devour. Yet you did not come back to me, is the utterance of Jehovah. I sent among you people a pestilence in the nature of that of Egypt. With the sword I killed your young men, along with the taking captive of your horses, and I kept making the stink of your camps ascend even into your nostrils, but you did not come back to me, is the utterance of Jehovah. I caused an overthrow among you people, like God's overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, and you came to be like a log snatched out of the burning, but you did not come back to me, is the utterance of Jehovah. Therefore, this is what I shall do to you, O Israel, as a consequence of the fact that I shall do this very thing to you. Get ready to meet your God, O Israel. For look, the former of the mountains and the creator of the wind, and the one telling to earthling man what his mental concern is, the one making dawn into obscurity, and the one treading on earth's high places, Jehovah the God of armies is his name. That concludes Amos chapter 4. But Jehovah is being patronizing of his people here. He's patronizing. He's saying, commit sins in great number. Offer invalid sacrifices. Commit transgression in abundance, because that's the way you normally do it. Make a sacrifice from what is leavened, which they weren't supposed to do. But Jehovah said that because he was being, very, he knew that he wasn't going to stop these people who were his people, but they were not acting like his people. He knew he wasn't going to stop them from doing wrong. So he was patronizing them. He was telling them something that my mother always called reverse psychology. Tell them to do it. And, if you don't want them to do it, tell them to do it. That's reverse psychology. You're not going to tell them not to do it, because you know it's not going to do any good in that case. But no matter what you call it, it's a little bit unusual for Jehovah to speak that way to his people. But he does do it from time to time. We've seen it, and we'll see it in different places where he talks to his people in that way. Like he says, make the number of your sins abound, because you're going to be punished anyway. You're going to be punished, and your sins are going to have to come to justice. You're going to be punished for them, so commit them as much as you like, or even more than what you normally do. Transgress more than normal is what Jehovah says. It's just very opposite to the way Jehovah normally speaks, or the way he normally thinks. He doesn't want his people to sin. Of course not. So we see a lot of different attributes of the true God, the way he deals with his people. He's not above speaking contrary to what people knew was the correct way, Jehovah's way, because in the case of these transgressors, they would only understand him if he spoke in that way and told them to commit more transgression. That's the only thing they understood. They didn't understand righteousness at all. So he spoke to them in the way that they would understand. But look at this. He said that he gave them cleanness of teeth, meaning they were starving and they couldn't eat, and they still didn't come back to Jehovah. And he withheld rain from them, so that there were two or three cities going to one city to try to get water, and they couldn't get enough. They still didn't come back to Jehovah. He struck them with scorching and mildew, and he let the caterpillars devour their fig trees and olive trees. They still didn't come back. The list goes on of all the things Jehovah caused to wreak havoc upon Israel, and they still didn't come back. So what are we going to talk about for the rest of the video, March 13th, 2024 of the Common Era? Well, there's always lots to talk about. I keep thinking, I want to talk about nutrition. It's not that easy, okay? Nutrition is not something you can just teach people. It's something that is a lifetime study from when you're young. Hopefully you're starting to study nutrition when you're young. But we couldn't study it when I was young because we had no internet. We had no source of information. If we could study it, we didn't know how to. We had no clue how to study it. And I think that's true even with people today, even if they do, as they do have the internet. Now that we have the internet, still a lot of people don't know what to believe. There's a lot of false information out there about nutrition, too. A lot of questionable information, at the very least, if not false. Very many things are false and questionable about nutrition. So what do you believe? It's really a lifetime study. I learned my first supplement was calcium and magnesium and vitamin D. Then eventually I found out that I need vitamin K2. And then after that I found out about all sorts of other different nutrients. And foods, too. I mean, it's not just about the supplements. Definitely it's about the food. Because matcha tea is a phenomenal food. And I didn't know anything about that for quite a long time. But once I learned about matcha tea, that changed the way I eat. Because it's such a powerful source of nutrition, and you can have it as a latte or just as tea with water and with whatever sweetener you may desire, but you can certainly make it a latte. Excuse me, what's wrong with my throat? Nothing, but it's just a little bit, I guess, it's the mucus-forming food. Oh, I've learned that it's not the dairy that causes the mucus like they have just had now in my throat. It's not the dairy that does that. There are many different foods that do that to me. So it's not the dairy exclusively, and therefore that's a good thing because I don't want to stop taking dairy. Now, most people can't eat dairy, and I think the reason is because they don't have vitamin K2, which is the calcium vitamin. But there's nobody who's going to learn this stuff very quickly. I don't care who they are. I mean, it took me since the year 1999 when I first started, I think, calcium as a supplement, until now, 25 years ago. Until now. 25 years I've been studying it. But I had a big head start in my education because I studied to be an engineer and a physicist, and that taught me a lot about doing research. But there's something I've always had an interest in, which was I want to understand my body and how it works. But it's just, you don't really, I mean, I've had an interest in the whole universe and how the whole universe works, but biology is more difficult than rocket science. I mean, it's far more difficult than all of these physics or, you know, equations of physics and all of the, I mean, biology is just, it involves every bit of physics and far more than that, because molecules move physically. They bang around inside the body, and so they're moving according to the laws of physics inside the body. And when liquids are, you know, mixing inside the body, atoms and molecules move at different rates through the liquid. They diffuse, and there's osmosis happening. But osmosis is a biological process across a membrane. But there's all sorts of physics happening with just physical velocity of how fast a molecule can move based on its size and all of these things. That's happening in the body. So physics is involved, but we don't normally think of it that way. We just think of it in terms of, let's find out what happens when we eat a certain food. That's how we study biology. And they don't always do studies on every type of food. They don't research everything. There's not available information on every food that you can eat. So there's no way anyone can help somebody else, which is why it's so wrong for doctors to try to help people by giving them poison or non-food in the form of, or even vitamins. Even if a doctor is going to give somebody a vitamin, that's not right either, because especially since the doctors don't even seem to know about or acknowledge the vitamin called K2, which is essential. And if you're giving calcium and vitamin D, or even just vitamin D to people, and you're not giving them K2, you're really hurting them. You're not helping them. And there's so many things to know about it that I can't recommend to other people what they should do, because there are differences in human beings. So it's wrong for anyone, including doctors, to be controlling what other people are eating, especially because it's not food that the doctors generally prescribe. Sometimes they do prescribe vitamins, but even that would be wrong, because it's preventing people from learning on their own. It prevents people from becoming self-sufficient in their knowledge of the body and how it works. It takes away the time that those people would have been able to spend learning about it on their own, researching it on their own. And people have to do that. I think that's what they have to do. Can't just depend on someone else to get the knowledge that they need. It's wrong to do it that way. And I can't be a source of knowledge. People can't come to me and ask me questions. That's just not going to work. It just doesn't work. I don't have time for that. All my time has to be spent researching, so I can learn, so that I can stay alive, so I can help people. March 13th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 19:21 hours, Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.